Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Ron Pariser. Today, I'll be reading from the May-June issue of Yankee. The first article is written by Mel Allen, and titled, Put Yourself in My Places. Nearly 50 years of writing about New England has given me travel experiences ranging from the thrilling to the sublime. Here are some of my most memorable, and the best part is, you can try them all, too. Illustrations by John S. Dykes. My Yankee life began in 1977, when I lived in an unheated cabin on the shores of Keoka Lake in Waterford, Maine, a village with a pretty town green and historic houses bordered by stone walls. I had no running water, the owner having drained the pipes before he left in late fall, so on winter mornings I chopped a hole in the frozen lake and carried buckets of clear, very cold water to the cabin, where I heated it on the always-stoked wood stove. I lived at one end of the lake, and after writing all morning, I would walk across the ice to visit with Alice Rounds, the postmistress and the owner of L.R. Rounds General Store, the village's social hub. The store was separated from the post office by short, swinging doors, and Alice's cry, I'll be right there, bounced back and forth between the two. I had never sent stories to magazines before that year, and whenever I delivered something I'd written into her hands, Alice would wish it a fruitful journey. In a Maine village where locals took their time warming up to newcomers, she skipped the preliminaries and became a friend. I tell you this because one of those stories had landed at Yankee. It was published in the October 1977 issue, my first byline in this magazine. I wrote about Waterford, the lake, a scenic mountain hike, orchards, a gem of a restaurant, and worthy sights overlooked by most travelers. The story ran without photos, only black type on white paper. Yet, within a few days of Yankee's arrival in their mailboxes, readers came to Waterford to see for themselves. A local cider maker told me people brought their copy and asked for his autograph. The chef owner of the small French restaurant said he was taking reservations for days. Alice's store had never seen so many new people at one time. Yankee had said, "Here is what you can see and do here," and so they came. I never forgot that trust that readers have in us, so in setting out to describe my most unforgettable places and experiences over these past decades, I combed through memories as if choosing from hundreds of family photos, knowing I can frame only a precious few. What exactly sears a place into memory is undefinable. It may be the power of a beautiful landscape or the exhilaration of a risky adventure. Sometimes it's simply the people I met whose stories touched me. And in making my choices, I wanted to be sure that these experiences are still out there today for you, the readers, who may be looking to make memories of your own. Perhaps because I was raised as far from wilderness as you can imagine, I sought stories in places so remote that sometimes you needed a bush pilot to get there. No wonder I was drawn to the North Woods of Maine. If you have never set foot in Chesuncook Village, or canoed on the west branch of the Penobscot River, where moose browse in the shallows, or had a registered Maine guide take you miles out onto West Grand Lake, or travel to the end of the road in Allegash Village, you may not know how far the cry of coyotes can carry, how close the stars can seem on New England's darkest nights. One winter, when my son Dan was still a baby, I strapped him onto my lap in a float plane that took off from Moosehead Lake. We soon put down on the ice of Chamberlain Lake. That's where I found Patty Nugent and her Nugent Camps, one of the most famous sporting camps in the state. Patty, then 81, met us with a snowmobile and a driver to carry us through deep snow to the cabins she and her husband Al had carved from the forest 50 years earlier. And over the next 4 days, while baby Dan was passed hand to hand among the small winter staff like a puppy, Patty told me their story. It began in the summer of 1936, when Patty and Al stowed all their belongings on a handmade raft, and paddled across Chamberlain Lake until they reached its eastern shore. That was back when you could stake claim to wildlands, and they had planned to build a sporting camp for fishermen and hunters. She told me about how they found the perfect location, as if the memory had been preserved under glass for her to admire the rest of her life. We started up the lake in a canoe, looking for a campsite, she said. Went up one side, came down the other. I looked across and saw a little green knoll. Nuge said it was located where the prevailing wind would keep the flies away. He put his arm on my shoulder and said, "Just right, little girl. This is just right." Years later, after the Nugents had gained national fame for their sporting camp, Al died of a heart attack while clearing wood. Patty put a stone on his grave with the words, "Just right." At the end of the 4 days, Patty bid us goodbye as we waited for the float plane to pick us up, and I can still hear her parting words. "I'd give everything back in a minute for just one night to do over." The night, me and Nuge pushed off and floated so slow up the lake, and in the dawn I looked across and saw that little green knoll. If I could have chosen where I'd want to be when a mama black bear bit me, it would have been right where I was, in the snowy depths of Baxter State Park, along Maine's black bear biologist. The park's 200,000-plus acres are the most revered stretch of wilderness in New England, and to me, the grandest place to step away from the comforts of daily life. If you don't know Baxter, look on a state map for the big green patch about 85 miles north of Bangor. Former Governor Percival Baxter spent more than 30 years buying up these mountains, rivers, lakes, and dense forests before giving it all to the people of Maine to be kept forever wild. The biologist was crawling into the dens of bears he had radio-collared months earlier. His task was to monitor how they were faring. I crawled in after him to watch as he jabbed a tranquilizer dart into one mother. Her cubs snuggled up against her. He would need her to stay docile as he took each youngster outside the den to weigh and measure it. I'll never forget the dank closeness of that space, or the life lesson I learned not long after exiting it. When a bear biologist hands you a net to drape across a den to ensure mother and baby stay separated, remember to ask, "Are you sure you gave her enough tranquilizer?" This particular bear, protecting her home, erupted from the den. A clamped jaw on my gloved hand and then my leg revealed her raw power, even though she had not eaten for months. It was worth the follow-up tetanus shot to always keep the memory of a bear living a life forever wild in the flesh. The beauty of the New England coast rivals any in the world. After sailing Maine's Penobscot Bay on a windjammer, I wrote about the tight quarters and the need for nighttime earplugs to dampen fellow passengers' snores, yet also about the intimacy that we felt with the bay and its islands, a feeling no ocean liner could ever give. I have witnessed sunsets around the world, but never one that could compare to when we anchored off a small island, color spreading so intensely across the sky that everyone fell silent. And how do I choose one beach? I have walked Maine's Popham Beach at low tide to Fox Island, then scampered back when the tide started to rise, ridden across the windswept dunes of the Cape Cod National Seashore, inhaled the solitude of Rhode Island's Napatree Point. With New England's hundreds of miles of beaches, I cannot explain why a barely half-mile stretch of sand 8 miles south of Portland, remains special to me. Except I think Higgins Beach has always been where I'd want to live, looking out to the twinkling lights of Prout's Neck at night. It was here that I slept in my all-time favorite room, the Tower Room at the Breakers, a modest inn as comfy as a favorite sweater that's been family-run since 1957. The room came with inconveniences. Third floor, low ceiling. But its 8 windows let in light and breeze, and the breaking of the waves sounded as clear as if I were lying on the sand. I awoke to the sunrise and settled before the windows in a rocking chair. There had been a storm, so the sea boomed. Just beyond a window, the flag waved. All the while, I sat listening, almost if waiting for the cry to hoist sails. One of the gifts that Yankee's longtime editor Judd Hale gave me was his blessing to find adventures. I was only the second journalist to join Wayne Hockmeyer, Maine's whitewater rafting pioneer, in plunging through the ferocious rapids of the Kennebec Gorge. I will always carry the mix of fear and adrenaline I felt when Hockmeyer told us, "A river gives no guarantees. If you are careless, you can go out." 8 years later, I coaxed my sister, Anita, and her 12-year-old son, Adam, to join me. Anita was just a year older than me, but she was a city girl. To her, outdoor adventure meant a drive in the country. I told her about the Forks and its community of rafting companies with their lodges, hot tubs, and restaurants. I left out Magic Falls and its 12-foot drop, where the pressure on the raft can shoot you like a champagne cork into the waiting Kennebec. Before we climbed into the raft, she grew quiet. "I'm not sure I can do this," she told the guide. "I'm an indoor person." The guide replied, "This is the outdoor adventure for indoor people." Right from the start, we were drenched by a river as the raft buckled and felt as if we were being sucked into a hole. Anita held on. When we pulled into shore, her face glowed. She promised to return and not be fearful. When Anita fell ill some years after, and we both knew the outcome, we would talk about all the things we had done together from childhood to then, and we always found a way to laugh, remembering how no matter how afraid she had been, she had done it, and she had not wanted it to end. Of all my stories, the one with the most apt title was about my foray into sled dog racing, the worst 30 minutes of my entire life. The near 6 mile race was on Wrangley Lake, and just as my 5-dog team was about to start, a blizzard flew at us out of nowhere. As the snow swirled, I watched the team ahead of me, whose driver, I had been assured, would look out for my team, disappear into the whiteout. The confidence I had gained from 2 days of training drained out of me, along with any sense of riderly adventure. Even now, I recall how my heart pounded as the dogs strained forward and the starter counted down. 4, 3, 2, 1. I was conscious of 2 shouts before all noise faded into the wind. One was from the starter, "Don't let go of the sled," and the other was from my dog's frantic owner, "We made a mistake." I did everything wrong that first day, including getting entangled with not one but 2 other dog teams, but I somehow struggled to the finish line, and the second day, under blue sky, we raced along as if I had been doing it my whole life. For days afterward, I would return to those moments when we passed other teams and the heads of the dogs would snap to the side, and sometimes there would be a low growl and a fleeting nip, and then we would be passed. And still, more memories seem to speak. "Tell them about me," they say. How can I not include my winter weekend atop Mount Washington, in the depths of winter, wind howling outside the weather observatory, the otherworldly rime ice coating the buildings, the feeling of how thin the line is between safety and peril in such harsh yet beautiful surroundings? Or the summer night when I joined thousands of people along the banks where Providence's rivers flow together to see the stunning water fire installation. Music cascaded all around, and fire tenders glided past setting bonfires alight. Every molecule of my body seemed to absorb the sounds, the light, and the smoke rising from the water. Or the day at Mystic Seaport, when I climbed down into the hold of the Charles W. Morgan, the last surviving wooden whaling ship, and felt what it must have been like to be a whaler, living at sea for months, even years, filling that hold with blubber and whale bones. Or when the owner of the North Hero House in the Champlain Islands, one of my favorite places on Earth, said he wanted to show me a place few of his guests ever saw. We turned off a dirt road just minutes from the inn, and suddenly the dusk sky was filled with a torrent of great blue herons coming home to roost, the sounds of their rookery making me feel as if I'd wandered into a secret prehistoric society. I want to end with my newest forever travel memory. In late October, my wife Annie and I, along with Rudy, our old Jack Russell, spent a week on Cape Cod in a tiny shingled cottage in North Truro. The cottage was called Little Rose, and in the mild ocean air, roses still bloomed. The beach stretched to Provincetown, and each morning we walked a mile or two before Rudy grew tired and I picked him up and carried him, his head resting on my hands. We then drove to P-Town and took in the heady mix of people and shops and endless bicycles, swerving in and out along the narrow streets. Each day ended at Race Point Beach. The sunsets there draw an audience every evening. But it was in the cool air of late afternoon that the seals bobbed past us, only a few feet away, diving through the waves. I watched them swim farther west until they vanished. I picked Rudy up, and as the sun began to set and the seals headed back to whatever bit of land they knew as their home, so too did we. The next article is by Ben Hewitt, Origins. Taking a parent back to her childhood home reminds us that every town is special to someone. Illustration by Tom Hogamat. My maternal grandparents were born in southeast Iowa in the early 1900s, in a place and era that strongly suggested a life forever tied to the land. My grandfather was an only child, but my grandmother compensated by being one of 12, and you can be sure that each of these children knew what it meant to put in a day's work. You can be sure that each of them knew the value of a dollar, and that no one complained about the patches on their clothing, or about sharing a room with their siblings, or that if they did, it was the first and last time they complained. When I was young, we would fly or take the train to visit my grandparents on their farm in Iowa, just a stone's throw from the Missouri and Illinois borders. I preferred the train, though I sure did love the moment of takeoff, the thrust of the jet engines, the impossible speed just before the plane nosed into the air. But I loved those long Amtrak lounge cars even more. I loved sitting and watching the landscape blur by, all those fields and forests and little towns that can seem so insignificant to passerby, but which serve as a container for the minutiae of the complicated lives of the people settled within. I think that somehow, even as a boy, I understood this. No place is ever truly insignificant, because no one is ever truly insignificant. Perhaps no thing is ever truly insignificant either. I both loved these visits and found them excruciatingly boring. I loved seeing my cousins, who lived across the narrow two-lane road from my grandparents, and whose lives seemed exciting, even exotic to me. All three were girls, and they wore their hair in stylish ways and dressed in fashionable clothes from the mall. I didn't know much about stylish hair or fashionable clothes, malls either, come to think of it. Of course, I loved seeing my grandparents too, but I was young and probably what I loved most was all the things that seeing my grandparents meant: a freezer full of ice cream sandwiches and creamsicle push-up pops, a TV with remote control, takeout from Kentucky Fried Chicken, a ride on the combine, maybe even a visit to the mall for new and fashionable clothes of my own. And I remember visiting in the winter and how when it snowed, my uncle would tie a plastic sled to the back of his Honda, three-wheeler, and tow my cousins and me around the farm until we got too cold or someone fell out and started crying. Sometimes we would stay for weeks, and that's when I started to become bored. Having gotten my fill of creamsicles and game shows, my grandmother particularly loved The Price is Right and its effortlessly dapper host Bob Barker, and 20-piece buckets of extra crispy chicken with sides of slaw and mashed potatoes. Maybe I even got a little bored with my cousins, too, who must also have grown weary of me, an odd little boy with a bowl cut and secondhand jeans from an odd little place far, far away. And the landscape. To my young eyes, the topography was featureless and flat. Fields of corn and soy everywhere you looked, all the roads laid out in a grid. It seemed to me you could drive for miles with your eyes closed, and perhaps the worst that would happen is you'd end up in someone's cornfield. So maybe I had not yet fully assimilated the truth that no place is insignificant. Maybe it's just that with time, the significance erodes, or we think it does anyway. Maybe that's what compelled my mother to leave her hometown after graduating from college, eventually making her way to Vermont and to my father. I haven't been back to Iowa since my grandmother's funeral, nearly 30 years ago. The farm has long since been sold, my uncle has died, my cousins moved away, Chicago, Omaha, Phoenix. My aunt has remarried, and she and her husband built a beautiful new home where my grandparents' old house once stood. So much has changed, yet many of the fields my ancestors first cultivated still produce crops. The small towns I used to ride through in the back of my grandparents' Buick, a Buick of course, are still there, quietly enduring under that vast Midwestern sky, full of people whose lives are just as complicated, challenging, rich, rewarding, and uncertain as my own. This summer, my mother and I are going back. She's 83, and I think she knows this might be her last visit to the place where she was raised, and to the people she was raised among, or the ones who remain anyway. I have a fantasy that we're going to drive. I'll rent some behemoth SUV, in my mind, a Chevy Suburban, shiny black with tinted windows, and she can recline in the cavernous back seat while I take the wheel, the miles piling up behind us like so much cordwood. I like driving, and I have an unusual endurance for long stints. Carrot sticks and black coffee, that's my secret. We won't talk much because my mother doesn't hear much, and will stop only for gas and bathroom breaks. I've already Google mapped it. 1,239 miles. 18 hours and 47 minutes. Hell, we can just about be there in time for dinner. Or maybe we should take the train. We'll reserve one of those fancy sleepers that we'll spend our waking hours in the lounge car, eating salted peanuts and watching the world rush by. I know my mom won't be able to hear a thing over the hum and clack of the train, so I'll pass her notes and communicate in exaggerated charades. Truth is, we'll probably fly. And that's okay, too. I still get a rush every time I feel those big engines kick in. I still marvel at the ingenuity of it all, and how in only a few hours you can trade one world for another. In this case, the hills and hollows of Vermont for the sweeping expanse of Iowa, and that sense of unlimited space, like now you can finally breathe in a way you didn't even know you weren't breathing before. And in between, far, far below us, all those cities and towns and people within them with so many stories of their own. I have a little time left in this segment. I'll read some more of the best of New Hampshire, the classics. Seafood. Petey's Summertime Seafood and Bar Rye. Founded in 1990 by Petey Akins Jr., this seaside staple has operated at its current Ocean Boulevard location for nearly a quarter century, serving steamed, broiled, and fried seafood in a casual setting. Nothing fancy here. You'll be eating that cup of clam chowder in a paper bowl with a plastic spoon. We recommend sitting at the bar. Don't be fooled by the summertime in its name, as Petey's is open year-round. It also ships fresh lobsters, steamers, mussels, and lobster meat anywhere you want. Stay. Omni Mount Washington Resort, Bretton Woods. While this historic hotel touts all the luxury you would expect from a world-class resort, its most prized attribute is its location. The simple pleasure of sitting on the hotel's back porch and gazing at the Presidential Range after a brisk hike at Arethusa Falls, say, trumps all the other amenities. In summer, those include gondola rides, golf, horseback riding, mountain biking, and zip lining. Resort. The NASWA Resort, Laconia. The Macris family has been hosting visitors on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee since 1935. Steeped in bright, rustic charm, their resort invites you to unplug from your busy life for a relaxing summer stay. Rooms, suite, and cottages offer private balconies, lake views, and wake-up service. Some are even pet-friendly. Amenities with local flair include a dock space for your BYO boat, a private beach, kayaks and paddleboards, a bistro, and the world-famous Naz Bar and Grill, so a refreshing cold beer or tasty boat drink is never out of reach. Experience a piece of history and know that no matter if it's your first visit or your 10th, you'll always be treated like family. Family attraction. Polar Caves, Rumney. Formed during the last ice age, the polar caves take you on a thrilling adventure into the distant past. There are 9 granite caves to explore, each formed by boulders that were deposited by glaciers hundreds of thousands of years ago. The negative space left between boulders formed exciting passageways that are ready for you and your family to explore. Follow designated walkways through the illuminated caves and don't miss the animal park, even though there are no polar bears. Ice cream. Super Secret Ice Cream, Bethlehem. It's no secret we New Englanders love our ice cream, but we also love the unpredictable. This farm-to-cone discovery blends local cream with ingredients that read like poetry for the taste buds. Cranberry ginger snap, coffee cardamom, Meyer lemonade pistachio, swirly strawberry jam jam. The tiny batch, made from scratch, ethos guarantees satisfaction. The ice cream flight of 6 cuts down on decision-making. A 2024 James Beard Award semifinalist nod is the cherry on top. Glamping spot, Alpine Garden Village and Winery, Bartlett. White Mountains? Check. Hobbit houses, cabins, and tree houses? Check. Handcrafted? Of course. Romantic? Off the charts. An on-site winery and a heated pool? Yes, please. This is glamping, but at its tip-top best, redolent with charm. Owls hoot. Hiking and biking trails abound. The Conway Scenic Railroad chugs by. You're in a cradle of scenery where beauty comes to be born. AlpineGardenGlamping.com. That's it for this edition of The Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the May-June edition of Yankee. I'm Ron Pariser. So long until next time.